Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Buckhead Business Radio Show.
All right, folks, good morning. Rich Casanova here, your host for this morning's edition of Buckhead Business Radio X. We got a great lineup in the studio this morning, some very exciting guests we're going to get to in just a moment. I want to thank our sponsor, Atlanta Business Networking, a listing of over 100 networking events throughout the city of Atlanta. You can tune into them and check out their site, atlantabusinessnetworking.com. We are live in the heart of Buckhead here this morning, and it's actually Earth Day, so our challenge is for each of our guests to, you don't have to, but if you think of something appropriate for Earth Day, I'll give you an extra bottle of water for that. Yeah, I don't know. All right, and we're right in the heart of Buckhead, and in the studio this morning we have some folks from ExecuSource. We'll be talking to some attorneys we have in the audience here this morning from family law as well as immigration law, so that'll be interesting. And we also have interesting group. We have several guests in this morning with an interesting event coming to Atlanta, and it's at the Atlanta Tech Village, and it's called FailCon. It's a whole day about learning about failure. So what an interesting topic and an interesting spin on things there. So Amber will introduce her guest in the studio for that this morning. But first up, it's my honor to introduce to our audience here this morning, Frank Green and Wyndham Pridgen, all right, with ExecuSource. And Frank, you have a diverse background in the recruiting industry, attracting developers and retail, retaining internal staff. You specialize in a direct hire and contract placement, right?
You got it.
Okay. And also in accounting, finance, IT, human resources, healthcare technology. And actually, you've been a recruiting and staff leader in Atlanta for over 15 years.
Right? I have.
All right. Well, welcome. And one of your, among your niche brands, you provide direct hire executive search, temporary staffing, contract consulting. How'd I do so far?
You covered most of it.
All right. Yeah.
Most of it.
And we'll hit on some more as well. And, Wyndham, you're also here with us, with ExecuSource, and you have a background or past experience with, Coca-Cola Corporation. I've heard of those guys, right? In the refreshment, sales operational elements, for North American business. But currently you're the managing director of IT at ExecuSource. All right. So, folks and guys, welcome to the studio. How are you this morning?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having us.
Very well.
Yeah, cool. So, ExecuSource, what's that all about? Tell us the, what's the backstory there?
ExecuSource is a 15-year-old brand in the consulting and staffing services space here in Atlanta. We are located also in the heart of Buckhead over at Piedmont Center. And we specialize in both the F&A space as well as IT. Our specialties regarding hiring frameworks are both contract, contract to perm, and direct hire.
Right. The company's 15 years old, but about 4 years ago, we decided to change the direction a little bit. Initially, we'd been doing executive search for the previous nine-ish years. And we decided with the economy changing, we needed to change too, and we needed to offer more offerings, really, to more services to the local market. So we developed contract as well as IT, as opposed to just executive search and finance.
And obviously, that's a huge industry, a big business in today's economy and world that we live in. What do some of your customers look like, or what are they most, you know, what attracts them, I guess, to your business and company organization?
I think primarily it's, this sounds kind of crazy, but it's the people. It's us.
Yep.
It's the fact that we are matchmakers. We've been doing this for a long time, and our goal is to hire people that are going to, or to place people that are going to make our clients more successful. And I think we're indebted, and we really feel like we're passionate about it. So I think it's us, the people within my organization, that make the difference.
And I guess the flip side on it, what about your consultants? I mean, what draws them to y'all's business?
Well, I think it's, you know, ExecuSource is very experiential in mm-hmm. the sense that we really, really try to heighten the kind of experience that our buyers and partners have, but also our consultants, as far as making sure that our focus is their career success, not particular business for us.
Right, yeah.
We want to see our consultants be very successful. We consider our consultants to be more ambassadors of our brand, and they're extensions of who we are and what our values are. And so it's very important that we make that match early in the screening and throughout the process. But we've been successful in doing that and placing some really great people.
And so who's your ideal customer?
An innovator.
All right.
it's an ideal customer across multiple industries, but an ideal customer would be somebody who is taking their product to the next level or looking to maximize effectiveness and efficiencies within their office and using technology to do that. We really don't have a particular industry or a particular demographic that we try to service only. We feel like our process and our people and the success of both can apply across multiple industries and demographics.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't know on a scale of 1 to 10 where I fit in technology as far as being a techno expert or have any working knowledge of it. But what are some of the trends you know you're kind of seeing in your industry or in terms of technology, and you know what's on the horizon, I guess? Or
well, I think the first thing, and this has been trending for a couple of years, is big data. And you've got cloud development, cloud security. We have a lot of clients who are looking to take existing data to the cloud, and that's always going to be trending. Big data is going to be, it's very sustainable. Innovations such as mobile development are big. How you can access certain portals through your mobile devices, tablets, et cetera, that's going to be big. So I would say those are the two biggest trends right now. Supply chain management, infrastructure, and network management also are trending as far as our business goes.
So Frank, what's next or whatever, after 15 years, I get, what's the next level, you're aspiring towards, or what's,
you know, it's, it really is. I firmly believe in there's constant improvement. We can always get better. We can always improve our processes. We can always be a better resource. So I can't necessarily tell you that we there's a certain goal that I have in mind, except for to be the best at what we do. To be honest, blow our competition out of the water. That's the idea.
Right.
So that's my goal.
So if you're listening, watch out.
Yeah,
seriously, they got you in your crosshairs.
That is exactly what we're up to. But you know, we've actually been really fortunate. Our revenues have doubled annually over the last 4 years.
Wow.
And in an economy that was struggling. I mean, I feel like we have done a great job, and we want to continue doing that. So I think we're doing things right, but we can always improve.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a great attitude to have. So, you know, temp to hire, and in terms of staffing, what do you see for? Are you seeing more permanent placement or for businesses or what?
Yeah, for sure. We definitely are. We're seeing that with the market improving, the employment market, clients, companies are ready to hire, and it's happened very quickly. So the talent pool is evaporating also very quickly. So we're finding that we're now taking a lot of resources and putting those into our recruiting and sourcing versus, quote, sales only. Right. Because there for a while, we were finding that most organizations weren't even hiring. So right now, it's definitely direct hire is extremely hot.
And so with big data, we're not going back to little data then, is what you're saying, whatever. It's all about big data, right?
It is. And that can blossom into so many different things, and spiderweb out to storage, security, management, development, maintaining data integrity. So
security's huge, right? It's like every day you hear something, right? I mean, how does a big brand like Target and Michaels and all these other people, it just seems like as a, you know, as an outsider, as just an observer sitting on the other side, I'm like, I'm just dumbfounded of, you know, how that can happen on that scale, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, companies are looking to retain as much of this data as they can, and as much information about their shoppers, their customers, their loyalists as they can,
right,
in order to create more.
Yeah.
Right.
To leverage that. But there's a balance here, because
there's always somebody out there that's going to want that data as well. And, right, and that's the challenge facing a lot of businesses right now.
Yeah, and you got to keep your eye on that for sure.
Yeah.
So for our listeners, how would they get? What's the best way to reach out to y'all, or you know, get in touch with y'all?
Well, you can catch us online, execusource.com.
Right.
You can also feel free to come by and see us. We're in Suite 150, Building 3 at Piedmont Center, and also follow us on LinkedIn. As well as on Twitter at Execusource.
I know we traded a bunch of Twitter feeds already.
That's
yesterday,
right,
and today,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So you guys are definitely very robust in your social media. The Piedmont Center, that's right down the road from here. And
absolutely,
it's right near the Atlanta Tech Village, right? Where, yeah,
it is.
We're all neighbors.
We've got some great friends at Tech Village, and certainly we feel like we're right in the heart of things here in Buckhead.
Yeah. I agree.
For sure.
Well, thanks for being here, gentlemen.
Great,
I hope
thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're going to go to our next guest and segment here. Actually, we have a couple of people. And Amber Saunders is the executive producer of FailCon. I love this idea. It just captured my imagination when I saw this. I'm like, serious, a whole day event on failure? But obviously there's more to this story, and it's very intriguing. Now, Amber's an attorney, entrepreneur, who's passionate to provide entrepreneurs with the tools they need to successfully start, fund, and scale their business. The goal of FailCon Atlanta is to begin a cultural shift that allows entrepreneurs to embrace their failure as a learning opportunity that can propel them toward success. Welcome, Amber, to the show this morning.
Thank
how
you.
Are you?
Good. How are you?
Unbelievable. Why not, right?
Yeah.
So, and you also have joining us in the studio here, a guest along with you is John. John, tell us a little bit. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about yourself. You fill in the blanks, whatever, right? From what I know, you're the CEO and founder of Array Fire.
That's right.
Here in Atlanta, you started Array Fire as a PhD student at Georgia Tech. You make software to help. This is a little bit above my head, but I'm going to try my best, right? Maybe if you can dumb it down a little bit for me, right? But you help scientists, engineers, financial analysts run their code faster. Actually, I went to your website. I watched that video that he had on there, and it kind of made sense or whatever. I was able to kind of see. But some of your clients include Google. They're up and coming. They're, I'd hold on to them. Lockheed Martin, Exxon, Adobe, Stanford Bank of America. And what's interesting, I don't know if this is more of your topic for the event. I think the second segment is maybe more what you're going to be speaking about at the event. Correct me if I'm wrong, but about, you're working on new startup projects underway aimed at providing, computing and visualization software. And you blog daily at, I love this one as well, this website, notonlyluck.com.
That's right.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Amber, tee this up here for us. And, talk about this idea of failure. How is that important in terms of the conversation, at your event, coming up?
Okay. So originally FailCon was started in 2008 or 9 by Cass Phillips in Silicon Valley. And the idea is everyone likes to tell stories about, oh, I made $1 million. Yeah. We're so awesome. We have millions of users. But you probably messed up about 20 times before you got to that million. And so unless you share that story, someone else who's starting, who's messing up, is going to feel like, well, I don't understand why I'm messing up and this person's making all this money and what am I doing wrong? And if people start sharing those stories and let everyone else know that, on that entrepreneurial journey, you're going to mess up. It's expected, not necessarily to celebrate it because that's a little odd, but to at least right. use it as a tool to help you correct those mistakes. Because if you don't look at it and you just keep doing what you're doing, you're going to make the same mistakes over and over again. And many of the mistakes that other entrepreneurs make, newcomers can avoid if they pay attention to what others did. So success leaves failures. I mean, leaves clues, but so does failure. Like if you look at both of those things, I think that the community together can avoid a lot of mishap.
So there's no after party for the failure.
There absolutely is. We have booze and all of that. But
right, yeah.
So
but now, because that's kind of the Einstein approach, whatever, right? And I've a little bit that I know about this. I think statistically, I think the uber successful companies, organizations fail about 13 times. It's their 13th or 14th attempt. That's when everybody's like overnight success, whatever, right? So who's your audience? I mean, who are you trying to draw to FailCon?
Well, honestly, everyone who started something or who's in, even if you work for a company, I think companies should have a culture that allows people to learn from mistakes. But essentially, it's for entrepreneurs, developers, anyone who's interested in business to come and learn from the mistakes of others. Like, I mean, last night when we were explaining it at Atlanta Startup Village, I had a student entrepreneur come up to me and say, well, how has Scout Mob failed? But Michael Tavani's going to outline 14 times
wow.
or 14
oh, wow.
ways that Scout Mob failed and they still built a powerful brand. So these companies that look like they're doing extremely well still have to outline their failure and still have a story to share so people can come if they're interested in learning how a brand like Scout Mob that everyone knows and everyone uses. I don't go to eat without checking my Scout Mob, but they messed up a few times before they even got there and made their brand powerful. So anyone who's interested in those kind of stories and learning from the mistakes of others.
So John, someone interested in entrepreneurship, which is, it just seems like it's everywhere these days and you can't pick up a paper, read something and not hear about the up and coming. So, what are your thoughts on getting started here in Atlanta specifically?
Well, Atlanta is a great place to right? be an entrepreneur, especially a technology entrepreneur in the last 2 years or so. It's just bursting at the seams here in Atlanta. So it's sort of the big sort of entity here in Atlanta is Georgia Tech.
Yep.
And just so much talent is there. This Thursday night, there's the Capstone Project. There will be more engineers gathered together showing off their final sort of semester of work than there are entirely at MIT, just in one room at Georgia Tech. And that's what we have here in Atlanta. And then out of that comes all these technology ideas. With some really big successes over the last few years, there's quite a bit of entrepreneurs in Atlanta that are very wealthy and have a lot of success behind them. One of them started the Atlanta Tech Village, which is where we have our office today. And there's over 500 members of the Atlanta Tech Village now, all one, two, three, five people companies. So you can imagine how many companies that breaks into. It's just a tremendous amount of entrepreneurship going on.
And it's interesting, the formula there. It's not in the sense of an incubator, but it's a startup environment. And then it's almost like they graduate you to move on, like BitPay, and originated there, and then they've grown beyond that, right? And that's the idea. It's kind of the evolution or whatever, right?
There you go.
And speaking of Georgia Tech, Shark Tank, there was a guy from Georgia Tech that was just on, I think, last week or week before, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, the Cycloramic was on there.
Yeah. So I think one of the, when you think about a business, right out of the box, business plan, right? But where does that fit in, or what's your thoughts on, that being, is that your first step?
Right.
Or?
Yeah, so the whole notion of, that if you have an idea, you should go write up a business plan and then share it with people and hope that someone invests. That's thrown out the window. Like,
really?
No one believes that anymore. Business plans are a work of fiction. Everyone believes that, everyone knows that when you write something from an idea and you project that in 5 years, I'm going to make $15 million or, personally, I wrote a business plan when I started this business. And 5 years in, I had $90 million in revenue. I was, that was my plan, right?
Right.
And, it never works out that way. And that's what I'm excited about Falcon, actually, is because it's the journey is has a lot of failures along the way, but you pivot, you iterate, and that's something I firmly believe in, that people that are competent people and doing something substantive, if they're persistent enough, they will be successful.
Absolutely.
And you just have to sort of overcome your failures and learn from them and pivot enough. But as long as you're not a fraud and not just sort of soaking it all in, they call that startup theater. As long as you're not like just participating in startup theater, you're actually doing something substantive, it'll work out.
So Ambers, what are some of the biggest obstacles, I guess, entrepreneurs face, that could be avoided or?
Well, I think that a lot of people have gotten caught up in what John calls the theater part of it.
I love that. I never heard of that, but as soon as you said that, I got it.
Because
there are movers and shakers, but like, what are you moving? You're not moving anything, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Exactly. And so just because you start a company, if you don't have revenue, you really have a hobby.
Right.
It's not a company until it starts making money. And so I think a lot of people don't do enough customer development. They don't know who they're serving. And so they're just putting something out there because they like an idea, but they haven't really figured out whether or not anyone will pay them for it. So that seems to be a huge problem. Like one of the speakers at FailCon went through Techstars, created the product, did everything, started pitching investors, and then at the end of the day, he only had one person buy the product after putting $250,000 into creating this because he didn't do the work in the beginning to figure out whether or not what he was creating was viable.
But the rest of the story could be if that one customer spent $300,000, then he's in profit, but not likely, right? Yeah. But I mean, I'm a huge fan of Shark Tank. I think I've watched every episode. I've been to events at Atlanta Tech Village. I mean, it's just very intriguing what's going on. I feel like I'm more of a spectator in this case, whatever, an observer or a reporter. But watching that, I'm amazed at Shark Tank. People come there and they get drilled down by Cuban and Mr. Wonderful. Where's your customers? Deer in the headlights.
You see, that's the main question. How much money do you make? Who are your customers?
Yeah, we can't define our customers or anything, right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if maybe they bring a couple of those people on just for entertainment value or whatever, otherwise,
yeah.
I'm like, how did you make it to that level? And you have 20 customers? I mean, serious? Okay, so I don't know if you can address this question. This is probably what the whole, we'll finish with how do they get tickets and where are the events at, all that good stuff. It's coming up actually this Saturday, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how can entrepreneurs, how can they overcome fear of failure? I mean, obviously that's going to be.
I don't think you overcome fear. I think fear is always there. It's whether or not you move past it. Like, I don't know to me, it doesn't make sense for me to beat myself up because I'm afraid of something. The problem comes when I don't do anything because of that fear. You just have to move past it. You have to do it anyway. You have to be willing to take risks and fall flat on your face and be embarrassed. But on the other side of that, know that there's going to be some sort of lesson. So I don't know if you can erase fear, but you can navigate around it and keep moving.
Okay. And John, I got a two-part question here for you. Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
So what should startups, you know, watch out for? What are some telltale signs, I guess, or whatever, or tip-offs that they're maybe going in the wrong direction or what have you? And how do you know that, you know, you've got this idea, how do you know you're ready to start, you know, an actual company?
Okay. Well, the first one is what to watch out for. So I'm a big fan of telling people there's only two things that matter. You got to build something and you got to sell it. And so if you're doing something that's not one of those two things, like you're wasting your time, you're spinning your wheels, and that's the biggest sort of mistake and source of failure for startups. And then, sorry, the second question?
Yeah, exactly. I knew I was going to trick you with a two-part question, yeah. So now, how do you know that you're actually at that tipping point and you're ready to pull the trigger and actually start a legitimate
right.
company?
Well, there's two things. One is, do you believe in the idea? And that's a tough one. Everyone's got a different sort of threshold for where they have to be in terms of believing the idea. But back to that business plan, you don't write a business plan. What you do is you flesh out what's called a business model canvas. It, basically, you still need to know what you're going to do and how you're going to make money, but you sort of flesh out your business model, and then you sort of pursue customer development. You get out of your office. All ideas, all facts exist outside your building. So you get out the office and you start talking to customers, and then the other one is just, it's a personal question. Are you willing to take the opportunity cost? So in my case, I started my company and I paid myself roughly 10% probably initially of what I could have fetched salary wise in a big company. And so are you willing to take that tenth of your salary opportunity cost? I did it for about 5 years.
Wow.
Are you willing to do that and hang on there and be persistent? Paid off really well my case at the end of the day, but there was a lot of failure coming leading up to that point.
But a lot of opportunities to give up or whatever.
Oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
So, Amber, what about, you know, talk about the conference agenda. I mean, who are we looking at? It's going to be, what's the lineup, some of the topics and speakers, what have you?
Okay.
Give us a teaser. This is your opportunity for your trailer or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so it starts at about 9 a.m. We have Michael Tavani of Scout Mob coming up about 9:45. He's going to talk about 14 ways Scout Mob failed and still built a powerful brand. We have Jeff Novich, who now works with the Kaplan Company, but he's a gentleman who went through TechStars and had a few companies. He has a lot of failure stories. I had to pare it down and tell him he can only talk about one. We have Ashley Iyer Brammer, who is a female co-founder of Southern Alpha. They're out of Nashville. So she's coming down and talking about the startup movement in Nashville. We have Corey Stanford from Blaze Track. Blaze Track created a platform for people who are interested in music and the entertainment industry to have mentorship from actual people in the industry through video responses. We have Eric Martindale, the developer evangelist from BitPay, who's going to join us. Chad Adam, Scott Bryan, of course, John's going to be there on a panel.
Yeah, John, what will you be talking about or discussing? Or
well, I'll be on a panel where we're talking about failure and how to scale and how to fund startups. It's just going to be sort of a general purpose question
just
and
open
answer.
Panel.
Yeah,
nice.
Open panel.
Yeah, so there, on his panel, it's the dangers of starting or forming, funding, and scaling a startup, because in each, those are the three stages most people generally focus on. So we're going to have three people talk about those things. We also have an interesting person. Quinita Frazier is going to talk about failure as far as mission-based businesses. So whether it's a nonprofit, which can be considered a mission-based business, or a company that is like in education that their goal is to help people do certain things, what does that failure look like? Is the failure when you're not meeting your mission or when you're not making enough revenue? They have two things that they're trying to meet there. So we have a lot of people. If you go to the website, you can see the full lineup, because I will probably forget all of those people that we have
coming. Yeah, and speaking of that, so how do folks get tickets or find out, or what's the, you know, website to register and?
Okay. The website is atlanta.thefailcon.com. You go on there, you can see all the speakers, the agenda, the sessions, the food, everything's on there. And then you can just click to purchase. The tickets are $100, but You can use a discount code FRIENDS50 to receive 50% off through Thursday.
It's good to know friends, right? Yeah. Well, thanks for being here, Amber and John. I really appreciate your time and the conversation here. And I look forward to hearing more about the event and upcoming events at, of course, ATV and beyond. And so thanks for being here. I hope you had a good time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. So next up, our next segment, we're going to talk to a couple of folks from the legal industry. We have a few lawyers actually in the room here this morning. And so first up, I'm going to introduce Randy, right? We can call you Randy.
Either one.
All right. Kessler, and you're the founder partner of Kessler and
Solomiani.
Oh, I love that.
KS Family Law.
Right. Nice. Yeah. And so, yeah, known as KS Family Law. And, you represent some high profile clients, particularly athletes, celebrities, and entertainers. You probably won't be able to name drop any people or, yeah. You have to have another lawyer present in order to sign off on that. Yeah. But, pretty exciting that you're a professor of domestic relations. Kessler, you teach at, John Marshall Law School in Atlanta, and also a guest lecturer at Emory University. You've presented at more than 500 legal educational programs across the U.S. and internationally. You frequently appeared on, this is what scares me, because now you're in my studio. We just opened here in Buckhead about, 10 weeks ago.
You are much nicer than Nancy Grace.
She's a
sweetheart off the air, but on the air, she's tough.
Yeah, well, I forgot to tell you guys, one of the things, Business Radio X, we should have told you before you went on the air, we don't do any ambush questions. There's no gotcha questions. This is not 60 Minutes. We, most media leans left or leans right. We lean business. So we're here just to pro business. So I forgot to mention that. So now I did. But so now you've commented on the topic of divorce and family law and high-profile divorces, including Anderson Cooper 360, The Today Show, Nancy Grace, as you mentioned, ESPN, CNN, quoted in Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, People Magazine, New York Times, Sports Illustrated.
Are we out of time?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Thanks for being here, Randy. Yeah. But now, high-profile divorces. Did ESPN and CNN have a divorce? I wasn't aware that they separated.
No. Actually, CNN had a divorce in Time Warner, but that was a different kind of
different
divorce.
Conversation. Yeah. Okay. So let's jump right into it. So this idea of family law and divorce—is it still true? We're still sitting at 50%?
We're sitting at 50%. I think people are waiting longer to get married, but it's 50% for a strange reason. Somebody might stay married for 50 years, but somebody else might get married 5 times. So if you ration it out, so probably one in every 2 marriages will fail, but a lot of them are second, third, fourth marriages. Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know if this is a loaded question, but why does a lawyer need to get involved in divorce, or what's the
You know, it's an interesting question. Why does a lawyer need to get involved? A lawyer doesn't need to get involved, but if you want to do it right or do it better, just like anything.
Yeah.
You know, if you hurt yourself, you can put a Band-Aid on it. If you break a bone, you can probably set your own broken wrist, right. But would you want to? The question is, what's at stake? And if there are children at stake or significant assets, then you certainly want a lawyer, at least to consult with a lawyer.
Yeah.
Just, you know, talk to a lawyer, find out what you could be missing, things that might seem obvious that are not, or vice versa.
Now, what about representing both sides? I mean, is that possible?
Can't do it.
I didn't think so. Yeah.
Whatever's good for you is not good for your wife.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm telling you something, it's probably bad for the other side.
I mean, have people tried that, or is that just written in stone?
Well, you could come to us and say, we've worked it out. Can you write it up? And we would say we represent one side, and the other side would have to sign a waiver. But pretty much, I think the best reason to meet with a lawyer is just for that initial consultation. You know, come in for an hour. Some lawyers will do it for free. Some will charge you. But it's probably the most important time you'll ever spend with a lawyer. When you talk to a lawyer and say, I don't know what to do. My husband served me with papers. Where do I go from here? You don't have to use that lawyer. You don't have to hire that lawyer, but at least know, what am I looking at? How long is it going to cost? How long is it going to take?
Right.
What happens with the kids? Those are the scariest kind of questions. And usually, if you meet with a good lawyer, you walk out feeling reassured that whether you like the answers or not, at least you know there are answers.
Well, you're dealing with an expert, right? I mean,
it's funny that we're talking about this right after FailCon.
Right, exactly.
Your marriage has failed. Right. .com.
But, they're going to work at it. They're going to work up a conference just for that or whatever. Yeah.
Hey, I'll help out.
Exactly. A little off topic, but actually kind of on topic. When you're talking about divorce and both sides of law, one of my favorite lines, I think of all time in movies, was from The Wedding Crashers. They're sitting across the table from each other. I don't know if you saw that. I think it was one of the openings.
The beginning.
Yeah.
Sure.
Beginning. And what was the cowboy artist was, the country. What's that? Dwight Yoakam was randomly just in there, right? And so the line was the wife's talking to the husband across the table, and she says, "Shut your mouth when you're talking to me."
That's funny. Right? You know what's funny? There's so many. That was a ride. You know those movies, Intolerable Cruelty and War of the Roses. I mean, they're crazy, they're so successful because there's some real emotion people feel, and everybody that's been through a divorce knows what those people feel like. You know, there's anger, frustration, hate.
And you talked about one of the biggest probably, goings on in the course of a divorce is the children and the the issue of joint custody. I mean, talk to us about that.
Joint custody is sort of the new buzzword. That's what everyone wants to have. And the truth of the matter is you shouldn't get caught up on the labels. Everybody should have joint custody unless somebody really is a horrible person. But then the real details are who makes decisions about education, who makes decisions about medical stuff so that you don't have to go back to the judge when you reach an impasse. There has to be a default person on that, you know, and, again, that's the kind of stuff you should ask your lawyer. You should read up on it. You know, I'm going to tell you about this book if you don't bring it up, but it's divorceprotect.com. Go to, it really is the initial consultation. It's what I'd like people to read before they meet with a lawyer. Or if you don't want to use a lawyer, read a book, read as many books as you can and just find out what the terminology is. Find out what joint custody means, because everybody tells me they want joint custody. What they should be telling me is what's important to me is education. What's important to him is religion. And you should figure out who's going to handle the important issues to them.
Well, what's the title again?
It's Divorce, Protect Yourself, Your Kids, and Your Future. And
yeah, I mean, you really should come into a consultation like that. You're not going to be an expert, right? But at least know the questions to ask, right?
Well, you'll save time and you'll save money, because if you ask me what is mediation, well, I can talk to you about it for an hour. But if you've read about it, then they can say, I know what mediation is, but can you explain how you use it or when it's appropriate or how long it takes or what, you know, we can take it to the next level. And I'm not charging them to ask me what is mediation. I'm charging them to
That's
tell
a good
me.
Point when you're charged by the hour.
Right.
Yeah, it does help to come prepared or whatever. Yeah.
Read up. Absolutely.
You're not charging us. We're not on the clock right now, are we?
The check's in the mail. Right. The bill's in the mail.
Oh, thank you. I'll take the check. But now.
You heard the one about the psychologist who met a lawyer at a party, and the psychologist said, listen, people can always ask me for advice and I can't get them to stop at these parties. And the lawyer said, that's fine. You know, what you do is, and he talked to him about it, and then he got home and the psychologist, of course, got a bill in his mailbox. That's how you, to get people to stop asking you questions.
Nice. All right. This idea of coming prepared there. I mean, maybe I watched too many movies or something like that. It's just coming to my mind. But, this thing about, the person, they go in to buy a cell phone. They've got 100 questions. Does it do this? Can it download this? Can it do this? They go to the doctor. They have no questions.
Same thing. You know, it's what you talked about earlier. It's talking about failing. It's talking about educating. It's talking about being prepared. Talking about the initial consultation, you can get so much information before you go in and make the final decision. Who to use? Do you want a divorce? You know, we've put out there a free child support app that, you just go, and every state has one where you can just pull up the child support app and see how much child support you're going to be ordered to pay or you're going to receive. Huh. And there's stuff like that that you should know when you walk in, and don't pay a lawyer to tell you how much you're going to pay. Pay a lawyer to say, all right, I think I'm supposed to pay $1,000 a month. Can you help me pay less because I can't afford that? That's what a lawyer should do, is help you figure out what the basics are, and then go beyond that.
To negotiate, yeah. So another thing that comes up quite often in TV dramas and whatever is this, you're in contempt of court, right?
Sure.
Explain that to us. I mean, in layman's terms.
It's a very powerful tool. You know, there's no such thing as a debtor's prison in America. You can't go to jail for not paying money, but you almost can.
Oh, thank God, finally. Okay, so that's my takeaway today, yeah.
On the other hand.
What a relief.
On the other hand, there's child support. So,
yeah.
You know, if you reach an agreement with your spouse and you agree to pay child support or to let him or her visit, and you don't comply with that agreement, you're not breaching an agreement. You're breaching a court order, because the agreement gets made into a court order in the divorce. The judge orders everybody to do what they agreed to. So if you don't pay the child support, not only are you breaking your agreement, you're violating a court order. The judge can hold you in contempt of court, just the same as if I stand up and the judge says, Mr. Kessler, sit down. And I stand up and the judge says, I'm holding you in contempt. It's the same thing. The judge can put you in jail. The judge can make you pay fees. It's a very powerful enforcement mechanism.
Yeah. Now, divorces, there's probably the whole spectrum from the, you know, easy kind of turnkey and in and out to very complicated. What's like a worst case scenario, one of the most complicated? How?
Well, to whoever's going through it, they're all complicated, and they're all hard, and they're all difficult. But the truth of the matter is there's some that are worth spending a lot of money on lawyers for, and there's some that are not. If you're fighting about $1 million or $10 million, you know, a $50,000 lawyer fee is really reasonable if you can save $400,000 or so. If you're fighting about who pays the visa bill, then you've got to be very efficient. On the other side, when you've got custody, how do you decide how much to spend on custody or an extra day with your child? So the complex ones that we see are when there are wholly owned businesses, sole owned businesses, people started their own business during the marriage. Is it a marital, you know, what's it really worth? You know, it's worth $1 million to the guy who started it, but could he really sell it for $1 million? You know, there are all these questions. You got to figure out what's in the marital pot to divide. And that's where the complexity comes in. Do we hire forensic accountants? Do we hire psychologists? And it can get quite expensive, but if the value's there, it's worth spending the money. But you got to figure it out.
If there's more at stake, you probably need more of a team involved.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right?
And a lot of lawyers are afraid to hire outside experts because of the cost, but I think that's valuable. Get an expert in accounting to figure out how much the business is worth. Get an expert in psychology to figure out which parent is better for the children.
I don't know if this is a fair question or, you know, I don't know if there's such a thing as like a divorce-friendly states or whatever, right? But I mean, is there a ranking? Like, I know
it depends on which side you're on. You know, perspective is everything, right? If you don't want to pay child support, then Nevada. We represented a woman who's the father of her child earned $200,000 a week. He was an NBA player. He was ordered to pay $900 a month in child support. This Nevada is very low. Los Angeles, New
York. Where do we sit in Georgia?
We're on the low end.
Oh, yeah?
We're on the low end. No matter how much you make, $3,000 a month per child is about what comes up. Every now and then there are exceptions, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000. But in L.A.
Oh, it's a whole – it's a game changer. Yeah,
there's a boxer. We represented the mother of one of his children.
Right,
he had a six-year-old here and a six-year-old in California. And in California, he was paying about 10 times what he was paying in Georgia.
Yeah, so I heard I think it was Truett Cathy. I heard him speak one time, and he said, you know, we operate in 37 states throughout the U.S. and one foreign country, California.
Oh, that's what they say.
It's a different place.
Yeah, California's different, but it's a good law and an interesting law starts there and creeps across the country.
Now, finally, we talked about mediation in divorce. You know, how commonplace is that, or how often, you know, percentage-wise, or out of 10?
It is everywhere. When I started practicing law about 25 years ago, mediation was just taking off, and most lawyers said, we don't need a mediator to tell us how to settle the case. And what's happening is we realize people need a catharsis. They need a chance to vent to somebody, and if they only have a courtroom to do it in, then they're out of luck because they're going to spend money to go to court, and the judge is going to say, this is what you do. So mediation happens in almost every divorce case, if not just because it's a good thing, but because judges know if they send you to mediation, you're probably not going to need the judge. The judge is not going to have to get involved in a messy divorce if you can resolve it yourself. So by all means, go to mediation. And if you don't, the judge is probably going to make you go to it.
And do your homework before you get to mediation as well, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Randy, I can call you Randy now.
Please
officially.
Do.
Yeah. So, what's the best way to folks to get back in touch with you or find out about, your practice?
There are 100 ways. RandyKessler.com, KSFamilyLaw.com. I'm a LinkedIn guy. You can follow me on LinkedIn, but just Google me, Randy Kessler, and depending on what you want, if you want the book, you'll find a link to the book. If you want our website, you'll find a link to the website. But thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Pleasure having you, and I enjoyed it. So I look forward to maybe additional conversations down the road. All right. And up next, we have, speaking of attorneys, we have a different spin on the legal profession. And we have our next guest in the studio. You're going to have to – I apologize. I was going to practice this off the air beforehand. You're going to have to help me with your – maybe your – well, definitely your last name. But your first name?
Laylee.
And the last name?
Eskandari. You can use my married name, though.
Yeah, Deal, right? Deal. I saw that. But no relation to the governor?
No, unfortunately.
I saw that, too, yeah. I have to be careful what I ask because there's at least three attorneys in the studio here this morning. So you're the founding partner of Atlanta Law Firm, and you focus primarily on almost exclusively on immigration and nationality law, right?
That's right.
You advise companies on global immigration issues, general immigration policies. You're the past chair of Georgia-Alabama chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and you've been named to the Rising Star list of super lawyers. I've seen super lawyers. I'm kind of new to this for the studio here, and we're working on a program just on industry-specific to lawyers, and this thing about super lawyers. Randall, you'll mind jumping in real quick. Tell us about super lawyers and both of y'all.
Well, you know, for years and years and years, lawyers could not market. They couldn't advertise, and now they're letting people market because – people that can't find lawyers need a way to find lawyers. So there were two companies that really let you be out there, and they rated lawyers, you know, Martindale Hubbell and Westlaw, and they had a lock on the market. Well, it sort of opened up, and super lawyers came into the picture, and they started rating lawyers. They talk to other lawyers. They rank lawyers. And then they present 5% of the population of lawyers as super lawyers. And if you're fortunate enough to be picked, they put it in the local magazines, Atlanta Magazine, and every now and then they'll do the top 100. And they it's a nice way to see who other lawyers – respect and who other lawyers think are good lawyers.
So that's kind of a big deal. No pun intended. But that you're the rising star of super lawyers. So congratulations on that. Yeah.
Very big deal.
Yeah. So tell us about immigration. I mean, that's probably one of the hottest topics. You know,
it doesn't seem to want to go away.
Right.
At this
point. So now, how does that affect the American economy? Yeah.
Well, you know, to use the old cliche, we're a nation of immigrants.
Yep.
And immigrants have always helped move the economy forward. They've always helped businesses have employees that they need. We've had from all over the world people who have come to the United States to make a better life. And I think immigration is a polarizing issue, but it's an issue that's not going away unless we look at it and we deal with it.
Right. Yeah, you can't just pretend it doesn't exist or whatever, right? Well, no matter what side you're on or what your viewpoint's on.
You can't ignore 11 million people.
Right. So now, specific to Georgia, I mean, how do immigrants affect or impact or contribute to the economy here?
Well, in Georgia, we're unique because about one in every 10 Georgians is foreign-born or a child of a foreign-born individual. So when, you know, you go through your day and you're talking to folks, I bet you're going to talk to several foreign-born individuals. You're talking to one now.
Right.
So,
where are you from?
My family was from Iran.
Okay.
I was born there, right. And I came to the States when I was very young.
Yeah.
So we went through the whole immigration process
right.
for better or worse, and and it's always intrigued me. But that's the climate in Georgia. We have a good melting pot from all different cultures. Our Latino group is growing. The Asian group community in Georgia is growing, and they're contributing leaps and bounds to the economy of the state. So I think in Georgia, if you look at it, Latinos and Asians wield about $29 billion in consumer purchasing power.
Wow.
So
just here throughout the U.S.?
In Georgia.
Just in Georgia?
Yep.
Wow.
So it's really, they're an integral part of the community here. You know, we get a lot of revenues from sales taxes, income taxes. And so it's a community that's growing and helping the vitality of our state.
Right. Now, from a consumer standpoint, but talk to us about, we've had the folks in from ExecuSource talking about staffing and employees, and we've had the folks from ATV talking about, startups and entrepreneurs. So it talks immigrant entrepreneurs and innovators. How do they make a difference here in Georgia?
Well, we have a lot, as you heard, Georgia Tech is one of the big schools for technology.
Right, John?
So we have a lot of foreign students that go through and get educated at our best universities, mm-hmm. especially in Georgia. We have several good universities here. So they are the ones who are starting up the new businesses. They're the ones, whether they're the big innovators and big shakers and movers or the person who's going to open up a local store and contribute to the local economy. But we have a lot of foreign-born immigrants and children of immigrants that are helping the economy and are building businesses and adding to the employment in the state.
But that's what our country was built on, right? Free enterprise and the ability to, without issue to class or whatever, or what's your background, your family, anybody can make it happen, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, talking about current immigration, the system, we try not to get too political here because we're very pro-business, but obviously it impacts every aspect of our lives, right? Talk about, how does this impact our U.S. businesses and, in terms of recruiting highly skilled, highly educated workers from, around the world?
Well, one of the things that I think as a whole, the U.S. is in need of is the STEM, fields, which is science, math, technology, engineering fields. And we have a lot of students, foreign-born students, who are coming to the U.S., who are getting educated, but then the employers can't hire them because there's not enough visas in the U.S. Just to give you a little bit of perspective on that, this year, Immigration Service opened the doors for the most commonly used visa, which is the H-1B visa. That's the visa for professionals of bachelor's or higher degrees. They opened the window to apply, come for the October year. We provide, or the government allows for about 85,000 visas. In the first couple of days, they received 172,000 applications. So now all of these individuals are in this crazy lottery system. So the employers don't know, am I going to get my employee that I want? And I'm going to invest money in this person. If I'm not going to get them, where am I going to get that, a similar person to hire to fill that need? So businesses are scrambling. Unfortunately, our broken system isn't meeting business needs. Business is saying, we need this, and the government's saying, sorry, we can't help you there.
The guys from ExecuSource, they're going to need a chiropractor because they're shaking their head or whatever, right? So you guys have seen that real world?
Oh, absolutely. The visa cap for sure, but also the issue of sponsorship and what employer may hold the sponsorship of that particular
Absolutely.
Resource and how limiting that can be for that resource to find great work. And in the technology business, there are so many niche technologies that are those technology spaces and functions are filled by immigrant workers who are just phenomenal, but so limited.
So how would reforming that? I mean, how would that affect government revenue, spending, the budget deficit? I mean, what's the ripple effect of that?
Well, if you look back in history, and some of the times you have to look back to go forward.
Right.
Back in the 90s, when we had a healthy economy, they had raised the cap on these visas to 120,000. And even though business, we were still meeting that cap every year, and we were, you know, businesses were exceeding it, that was the time when the economy was healthy. So now looking forward, if we can match what our business needs are to what the government will allow, you know, the businesses can get the talent they need. They can have the jobs in the U.S. When your talent has to leave the U.S., when we're educating these students and we're sending them back home because we can't keep them here, well, there goes our jobs too, because now employers are going to relocate to where the talent is. So if we can keep the talent here, we can move the economy and forward to make it prosper.
Well, what you're hearing, I mean, it makes sense. Whatever, I can hear the passion. You should run for office, whatever, make a difference, whatever, right? But so immigration reform is not just about, we've been talking business, obviously, economies and economic, the impact and so forth. But what about a real world, I mean, impact on, you know, these, you know, affecting real people?
Well, you know, we talk about business and we talk about the economy, but it really is about families as well. In recent years, we've deported more individuals out of the U.S. than in any time in the past. And what essentially this does is it rips families apart. We're a society that's built on family values, yet we are tearing parents away from their children. So we need to find a way that we can bring balance to security issues and the needs of the country being able to protect itself, but we're deporting people who've never committed any crimes. Right. So I think we need to look at it in that aspect as well. It's just not about money. It's about families.
Yeah, it has to be on a case-by-case basis. But when you get into the courts and the scale of this, I mean, it's tough. You know, I mean, how do you – that's a lot. That's a lot to take on or whatever, right? And yes. You know, but at the end of the day, it should be about that individual. What are they contributing or taking away, or what's the trade-off there? Tell our listeners, our folks, what's the best way to get back in touch with you and find out more about what you're doing to change the world, at least here in Atlanta and Georgia? Yeah.
Well, you guys can get through to our website at www.leimmigration.com. You can email me at laylee@leimmigration.com. I'm through the Super Lawyers website, through Avvo, through LinkedIn, through all the different ways everybody can get in touch.
Yeah, I think we just connected on LinkedIn
yes.
as well. Yeah, nice. Well, thanks for being here. I enjoyed
Thank
the conversation.
You so much.
And it's a springboard maybe to some change or whatever, right? So you're doing good work.
We hope.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So finally, our anchor man this morning, we're calling him in the studio, is going to bring us all home and tie this all together with some interesting.
You're not going to drop anchor, are you?
Right, exactly. Well, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. Yeah. So Michael Crandall is our guest in the studio here this morning. And a little bit about Michael. You were adopted as an infant, raised by an out of control alcoholic who untimely drank himself to death at the age of 55. I mean, we'll talk about this, you know, how you overcame that. But at the age of 16, this is astonishing. You made more money than both your parents combined in your real first job in a small town in Twin Falls, Idaho.
That's
right. I'm sharing what you've given us, right? So this is another astonishing. You graduated an unimpressive 217th in your high school class. How many kids in that class?
Rich, there were 434 in my class. I graduated 217th. And to this day, I have not yet figured out if that means I graduated in the top half or the
right,
bottom
exactly,
half
yeah.
of my class. Now, the fact I can't figure out is probably indicative of why I graduated 217, but everywhere I just told you is true.
But ultimately, you graduated to the following. You presented the keynote address at the MBA conference of Northwestern University, famed Kellogg School of Management, guest lecturer at Purdue University. You presented countless leadership seminars, authorized authoring dozens of magazine articles. And most interesting, I'm on chapter 8 of your book, Life's 10 Point Must Systems. It's a great book. I really enjoyed it. We talked about it a little bit yesterday in a conversation. But, you believe that anyone, regardless of how much baggage or maybe failures that they've experienced, FailCon, right? Can we do another plug for FailCon?
Exactly.
No matter what they've gone through, baggage that they carried around for years that, doesn't have to weigh them down, right? Because sometimes
not.
That can define you.
Absolutely not.
Right? And you currently reside in Buckhead and, with your wife. And, finally, your title and your business card, you gotta love this, is followed by CNG, which stands for Certified Nice Guy. Welcome to the studio here, Michael.
Well, actually, it does, says Michael Crandall, CNG. I've used that for about 25 years and had a ball with it. Yes, it stands for Certified Nice Guy, but everybody here at the table needs to understand, in my LinkedIn, in my book, my amazing articles, I do clarify that I am a self-certified nice guy, but a nice guy nonetheless.
Nonetheless,
still a nice guy.
So, the topic we're going to talk about, which I think kind of ties into an earlier conversation, is, one of the blogs or the articles that you've written is this idea of, the only reason you were hired. There's a single reason why people are hired, right?
Yes, there are. There's okay. only one.
And, so in this formal postings of job openings, they always list what specific requirements, the skill sets of, professional abilities, college degrees, what have you. But, what they really don't tell you, what's the one thing they don't tell you that they're actually looking for?
The one thing that no one will really come right out and say is because maybe the hiring executives never even put it, those words in their own mind and had it come out their mouth. Maybe they have, but they're too shy to admit it. But even the clients here that engage a Frank and Wendell's expertise, they may not actually say it. But deep down, it sounds so simplistic and self-serving. But the reason any of us were ever hired for any position, and the truth be known, even though we have admitted, the only reason we've ever hired anybody else is this fact. You're hired to make your boss look good. Period. That's why you're hired, is to make your boss look good. Now, they can't put down in the classifieds, and I used to have them. Now you've got the monster.com and Career Builder. But if they're smart, they engage the services of an executive search firm like Frank and Wendell. But they won't really admit it, but your job is to make your boss look good, period. It is.
Yeah. So now most people go through their days or weeks or months, better part of a career, focusing on the wrong job, right?
Most people don't know what their jobs are, but they do focus on something very clearly. Most people, rather than spending the time, a leader's job, by the way, is to make everyone around them successful. People above them, beneath them, around them, your job is to make everyone around you successful. Most people don't understand what their job is. Instead, they posture, they preen, and they spend all their time trying to make themselves look good. And granted, you gotta be good or you're incapable of making your boss look good. Don't misunderstand me. But if your main focus is how I can position myself to look good, it won't take long for people above you, around you, that nobody likes to work with a know-it-all. And if you use every opportunity you have to try to make yourself look good, the bus, the train, the ship is going to pull out of port, and you're going to wonder, hey, what happened? I thought I was looking great. And the fact is, maybe you were succeeding all right, but you were succeeding at the wrong things. When Amber was talking and her FailCon, a lot of people believe that failure is to be avoided. I happen to believe that one of our big problems in management and leadership is that it's not so much failure, it's succeeding at the wrong things. And if you don't know what your job is and you think you're succeeding at it, you need to think a little bit harder. And if you don't think your job is to make your boss look good, just ask him or her. And look at their face. Now, they may not be able to say, yeah, your job is to make me look good. But you can tell by looking at them, there is no way they're going to say, oh, gee, that's not what you're here for. Where'd you get that idea? I guarantee you.
So I think Frank was telling who's making who look good here or whatever, right? Yeah.
Well, so he better make me look good. That's why I hired him.
Yeah, absolutely. Well done, yeah. Okay, Wyndham, yeah, just checking in on you there.
Well, with Randy, with Randy's clients, when they retain his high expertise, and unfortunately the divorce examples and cases, it's for sure his clients are saying, what is it you can do to make me look as good as possible in this particular situation in my life? Everyone here at this table here, at Rich Casanova's, its show, and quite frankly, we want to be part of a good show. We want the people around the table to look good.
Yeah, good thing you guys weren't here yesterday because, no. But
you know, Mike,
we didn't do a show yesterday, so we're covered, yeah, for legal reasons, yeah.
Mike, you say that. It's interesting. What I like to tell people sometimes is I build, you know, a lawyer has to have a good reputation so the judge will listen and hopefully hear what they have to say. I want to build my reputation, and then I want to lend it to my clients. You know, I want them to be able to hire me because they will get some good reputation by osmosis or by being around us.
Yeah, what's that company, the company you keep, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it's about.
Successful
but
leaders.
I want to go back to this idea, and maybe Amber can jump in on this as well, but this idea, I had a little bit of an aha moment there, is that we talk, you know, this thing about failure and entrepreneurship, right, and the challenges with immigrants, whatever, and there's some synergy here in the conversation, but this idea of fear of failure, right? We don't want to fail at something, but we're going to only be, you know, we're going to only be successful at the small stuff in life, maybe, right? Because is it a comfort zone thing or kind of your self-image, right? Because you're like, well, I'm not going to attempt this because my makeup says that I'm not going to be able to achieve it. So I'm only going to achieve and be successful at this level. Yeah. Yes or yes? Yes or
no,
yes? Yeah.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that, people tell themselves, there's a book by Seth Godin called All Marketers Are Liars / Storytellers. And the one thing that in the book I think that applies to everyone in business or in employment is that people tell themselves stories. So if you told yourself that they hired you because, you know, you had all of these degrees and you had all of this whatever, as opposed to they hired me because I'm supposed to make my boss look good, then when you go into that job, you're going to perform based on whatever story you told yourself, as opposed to whatever the reality might be. So, I mean, even in business, if you told yourself the story that if I fail, I'm going to be ashamed, everyone's going to look at me, and no one else is even listening to that story, you just told that to yourself, you're not going to be able to function or do certain things because of whatever it is that you told yourself.
Speaking of Seth, I mean, I think there is a quote. I was scrambling here, flipping through the pages of your book, Michael, trying to find the quote, but I believe it was where it says, just because it's low tide doesn't mean there's less water in the ocean or something
right,
like that.
A lot of times everything is relative, but you look at where you are and you see like, oh my gosh, the tide is low, what's going on? And the fact is in the cosmos that if water's not in one place on the earth, it just means it's someplace else.
Right.
And you got to position yourself to be there.
Is that blue ocean strategy, right?
Right.
Well, to making your boss look good, and I'm emphasizing that, to put a ribbon around it, if building and maintaining exemplary management teams is accomplished by identifying talent, mentoring them, and monitoring accountability for terrific results with a style of leadership based on positive support and empowerment rather than fear or micromanagement. And if great individuals thrive throughout the entire organization and routinely makes everyone around them look good, by default, your chief operating officer is good, and therefore your chief operating officer is in a position, and only in a position, to make the CEO look good. And then the board looks good, and most important, at the very tip top of the organizational chart, meaning your shareholders and your customers, they believe that this brand is far more than just good. In fact, it's the best there is. Now, that culture only happens when everyone there has got everybody's back, and in the truest sense, they believe it, they live it, they want to make everyone around them successful, and that's what a leader is all about. Successful people aren't people that don't have problems, they're people that handle problems well.
Right, yeah. Well said. So that's kind of the flow chart, right, of a business, real-time business scenario?
Well, you can
It's hard to kind of draw it on the radio.
Let's say you have a search committee, or if it's done, or they've done it externally and they've hired expertise and executive search firms that have expertise in our industry. It works basically like this with some quick bullet points in your mind. There's a search committee, and they basically want to select a new chief operating officer, for instance. And they're basing this selection on the prediction that that person will ultimately make them look absolutely brilliant. Then the CEO, once you are hired, that's your new boss, they want the board and the vice presidents to look good. But your boss can't look good unless you're proactively championing their vision and having it looking good. And you're only capable of making your boss look good if your direct reports are doing the same to you. And if they're not, that means you're incapable of doing your job. You're not doing your job by making the people above you look good. Because in fact is, management is only as good as the good hires surrounding them who know what the real job is and make everyone around them successful.
That's some good stuff right there. So, so Michael, how would our listeners get back in touch with you? What's the best way to reach you? Or I know you're. We'll post your profile, your information on the website as well as with everybody. We'll have all your content, all your links on there. But you have your book on Amazon. Is that the best way?
Yeah, the book. I'm not here to peddle books, by the way, at all.
Well, I'll peddle them for you. Whatever. It's a great book.
Yeah, the book is available. It's Life's 10-Point Must System. It's available on Amazon.com.
Cool.
I'm one of the few people left in the cosmos where I return personally every single call. Don't be shy. If it rings and I don't answer, I will get to you within 24 hours. That's just what I do. And that number is area code 760-464-6103. And at LinkedIn, just go ahead. You just go onto LinkedIn and you just put in Michael Crandall with one L, C-R-N-D-A-L, but then put in the initials C-N-G, and I guarantee it, nobody else is going to come up but me.
Nice. And that area code's from Palm Springs, is that?
Yeah, my wife, by the way, Kim, I like to describe her as the most beautiful woman that God ever created. Plus, she's not too tough to look at either. But we moved here from the Palm Springs area, where I was chief operating officer of a Thunderbird Country Club, which was full of entrepreneurs, very successful people from around the world as members. Learned a great deal working with them. But she and I moved here to Atlanta, and we absolutely love it.
Right here in Buckhead. So welcome to the show. Thanks for being here. Michael, appreciate your time. And and to all of our guests, it was an amazing hour, probably one of best hours of the week, maybe this month.
Did we make you look good, Rich?
Oh, I'm feeling great. Yeah, I don't even have to elevate the chair anymore or whatever. Yeah. So I'm going to leave you with a closing thought. This was inspired by reading Michael's book. This is your homework assignment for everybody in the studio and our listeners today. Do what you promised you would do, and life will happen in abundance. So with that being said, we'll see you all next week on the next edition of Buckhead Business Radio X.